Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast where we discuss classic works of management and organization studies. This is part two of episode 57, where we are discussing Stephen Kerr's article on the folly of rewarding A while hoping for B, originally published in the Academy of Management Journal in 1975, and then updated in Academy of Management Perspectives in 1995. Participating in the discussion are Tom, Ella, Michael, and Fritjof. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So right at the end of the article, Kerr comes in with this statement that puzzled me somewhat and that I find quite remarkable. He's just been talking about how altering the reward system is the way to go to solve this problem. That way organizations can escape the necessity of selecting only desirable people or of trying to alter undesirable ones. So both of those things have been shown to not really work. What we need to do is change the reward system, and then we will basically have a situation where no one needs goodness. So because the system just works so effectively, it rewards all the right behaviors that are sort of satisfactory to the whole system. And he refers to Skinnerian terms here. He says, you know, goodness is not needed. There's no kind of moral or ethical imperative required. No one's putting themselves second. Everyone's getting the rewards that they want, and the system is running effectively. And I thought that was pretty remarkable, but I'm not too sure why that I reacted to that. So did others react to it as well?
Yes, I definitely reacted to it. It sounds absolutely wonderful in theory, but it just sort of flies in the face of anything that I understand in terms of systems thinking and complex adaptive behaviors, which says that no matter what system you put in place, the natural dynamics of human interaction means that it's going to change. It's going to break down is what I think it would be. And you'd have to put, you know, in order to keep any sort of a reward system working, just by definition of being a system, you have to put energy into it. And it's not a matter of just putting raw energy into it. It has to be to kind of get it. It's going to wander off in entropy. You got to push it back to where it needs to be if it's, you know, to perform its and sustain its original function. So yeah, it sounds wonderful. If you could have a system that you can just let it cook and it'll cook forever. But even, you know, pressure cookers or other kitchenware breaks down over time.
Yeah, I was also puzzled by it, and I agree. I mean, well, who can think of a system that creates goodness in its in itself? It also keeps me puzzling this last remark of the article, and it's actually not a line by himself, but he refers to another article. So quite curious that what's that about?
I was thinking, like, in a way you. Yes, one of the discussions we're having in like the design literature is the idea of that, yeah, you can't do the one-off design anymore. It's just things are getting too complex, which means that you need to continuously design your systems. And I think that's at least what I was reading in here. That yeah, if you sort of say think that you can make a system that will require no more goodness from people at one point that will work forever, then yeah, that's like Tom said about the systems, that's just yeah very yeah naive almost. But at the same time, isn't it maybe also good to think of humans as inherently also a bit good and design the
that was sort
system,
of more my fundamental concern, I think, is there is value in encouraging a sense of virtue in people. Perhaps that's just my ethics. But the thought that you will never have to sacrifice or go second to someone else to support their goals because you can always get a reward for doing the right thing. It just seems bizarre to me that you would want a world where that was the way things work. But then again, you know, these ideas of designing a system where this can be the constant state is, I think, the goal that behavioral economists have. And, you know, they sell solutions on the city level, for example, around these nudging interventions that will, I don't know, make you recycle or be a better citizen. And that's not about you recognizing the impact you're having on the world and making some changes to your consumer behavior or making a bit more of an effort to take your cardboard down to the bins or something. It's about how can we manipulate you to think that that is a behavior that's aligned with your immediate concerns and goals, even though it's actually serving the greater interest, but that's a sort of trick. So I actually think that this thinking or this perspective is alive and well, this hope.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure if this article is read in the behavioral economics and behavioral public administration, where it's also which is also developing how does government influence the choice architecture. So I'm wondering if this idea by Kerr from the management perspective has also been picked up by the behavioral economics and public administration communities. Maybe another point, Fridtjof, you mentioned your design perspective, and of course, in design, there is this idea of trying to have people involved, so co-design, you might say. What are rewards in design thinking to have people and also designers, maybe municipalities, private organizations, to cooperate, work together, and align their goals as well? Could you maybe say something on that from your discipline?
But I didn't understand your question. So how, as designers, we'll deal with these kind of rewards?
Yeah. So maybe how, if you take it from a design perspective and look at this this argument, this article, if there's something on social design, how do you get people, governments, private organizations aligned in cooperating towards a similar goal, because you mentioned that the idea of goodness is somewhere actually in the background of design. We are designing for a better society, you might say.
Yeah, I think so. One of the things that are important in design is the role of purpose. So that when you design something, you always design it for something. So you can't just design a glass. You design a glass for, say, drinking out of it. And so if you say, for example, think about design organizations, and I would say that reward systems are part of that, that you have to keep in mind what is actually the purpose that we're trying to achieve with this organization, and that this purpose keeps changing as well. That, say, being the same company with a purpose for 20 years, maybe that doesn't work. Maybe you need to keep updating what you're actually trying to achieve. And I think one of the ways that designers sort of say deal with these multi-stakeholder perspective is indeed what you just said about co-creation, that you try to involve the different stakeholders also in the creative process to give their voice enough place, so to say, that everybody feels involved and everybody feels heard. And that already allows the different stakeholders to come together. And then I really like this idea of Mary Parker Follett of the unifying purpose. So that you're trying to find something that somehow brings these people together. So even though they might have different interests in the end, but that at least halfway somewhere you can find something of a unifying purpose that brings these people together. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, sure. And a unifying purpose, could you also say like a unifying reward system then?
Yeah, but I think that's kind of what I meant with the problem that I have with, on the one hand, sort of say designing a system that where there's no goodness versus trying to design a system where maybe the goodness still has a place, but where you don't just hope for goodness to solve everything, but you kind of design for the goodness of people to take care of the things that you didn't think about.
There's just a natural question that comes to my mind about what we mean in this context of goodness, because when I think about two different contexts in which you were talking about the intersection, various intersections of organizations, such as like a large hierarchical organization with sub-organizations who are geographically displaced or functionally diverse. And you want to have a reward system that is fair and just across, rather than say good, I'm going to use fair and just instead, to ensure some sort of equitable treatment across all of the subordinate organizations. And yet, each of the subordinate organizations has its own context where it's going to interpret the reward system differently. And they're going to have their own reward systems that will be different. And the conflict that might exist at different hierarchical levels can induce all sorts of problems and inconsistencies that have to be monitored. I mean, it's going to be complicated. And then the other one is one where I'm thinking about organizations and the professions to which they belong. A profession, I'm using Andrew Abbott version of a profession, where it's about a domain of expertise, a function that societies perform in a corporate body. And so when we think about the medical profession, you have medical corporations or medical, hospitals, clinics. You also have private doctor's offices, all sorts of different types of organizations within the profession. And at the professional level, you want to reward the proper provision of care for patients, et cetera. There's a whole set of professional values that are going to be espoused across all of this diversity of organizations. But each organization, because it's got its own boundary, its own purpose, in many ways may adapt or may come into conflict with the espoused professional values. So that these layers of organization and relationships between organizations, I think, is going to influence the way that the purposes are defined and how different organizations enact those, interpret and enact the purpose.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Tom. And it reminds me of an article that came after the original Kerr paper. And this article, we have a link to it, is called On the Wisdom of Rewarding A While Hoping for B. So a twist on Kerr's paper, saying it's not a folly. There's actually a wisdom in having these more complex reward systems. Well, they define it in terms of forms of complexity. And one of the points they make is that in the real world, sometimes an individual has to serve two masters, as in a classic matrix structure. And that reminded me of what you were just saying, Tom. So product and functional demands can't be made perfectly consistent with each other. So you can't expect an organization to make them so. And so you can't just have this one goal, which then the reward system aligns perfectly to, because you're always going to have more than one goal or more than one set of aims that people are trying to achieve. So they in this article introduced different kinds of complexity, and that was one of them that you just reminded me of.
So that's the complexity is actually a part of organizational, or complexity, ambiguity is part of organizational reality, and then it becomes a wisdom, of course, that there's no alignment in that sense between behavior A and reward B, you might say. So the specific article also refers to the institutional perspective and the idea of decoupling, which is very much in line actually with the analysis that we're actually that there's a difference between formal structures and actual work activities, a difference between the support from the environment and the way people and management in the organization are doing things. This is a very well-known perspective, of course, in management and organization theory. Maybe we could also try to focus on one of the examples and one in which we are very familiar with, the university as an example. In which way do we serve more bosses? Do we are we influenced by different aims and goals? What are your perspectives on this?
Absolutely. Certainly, even though I belong to an organization, I also have obligations to the academic communities from which I come from. And I also have responsibilities to, in my particular case, because I'm serving in a military educational organization, I have obligations to the military as a primary client. And obviously, the rewards are going to be there's a lot of conflict that comes up, not in terms of mainly in terms of time, and in terms of what types of who determines what it is that you need to do. Is it the teaching mission? Is it the reward, the scholarship mission, or is it the service? You know, it's the same type of three-legged stool that all of us as scholars try to balance, but the type of an organization to which we belong determines what that balance looks like, and it's very dynamic.
Absolutely, and this is something that I think everyone is grappling with, and increasingly additional aims are being added. So, for example, there is an increased emphasis in academia on speaking to the public. And, of course, that's something we believe in, and that's why we are doing this podcast as well. But say if you write an academic article and it gets published in a very highly respected journal, that's very likely to have a paywall on it. So that's locking away this knowledge that you've been working on. And so you want to get it out there to the public. And so an avenue to do that is to write a newspaper article. But in order to get it into the newspaper, you really have to abstract the message, kind of like what Kerr has done, and make it quite simple and attention-grabbing. And a lot of scientists are having a real problem with this because they know that they need to get their messages from their research across to the general public. But the goals of the newspapers where you publish these messages are, of course, quite different, and their norms are very different. And so they're likely to distort a research finding into something that's overly simplistic or a bit sensationalistic. And so there's a fear then associated with trying to communicate to a wider audience with your research findings that I think really gets at some of this complexity of competing goals. And it's not clear where the rewards lie there. And which of those rewards you should be paying attention to. So it gets very complicated.
I agree. And not only for research. If I look at our institute, it's we have a merit model. I'm not sure if that's a very common practice, but you get rewarded, you might say, for not only in research, the R in merit, but management, education, research, as I said, impact, team spirit. And these are all five factors, you might say, that push and pull on you as an academic. And well, of course, research is quite easily tracked in numbers of publication and funding and these kind of aspects. Education is already a bit more difficult, but how do you measure impact, management, maybe also team spirit? So the complexity is, I think, is the real thing here. So the article you found, and that's on the website, I think it's very relevant for the discussion of this this Kerr article.
Yeah, kind of going back quickly on the point of having to bring your message public in research. I'm just kind of curious. This is sort of an open question. I definitely don't know the answer. Is to what extent does the prevalence now of podcasting, of TED Talks, of audio and visual means of getting things to the public, not just words, impacting how we perceive the impact of a scholar? And is it distorting? And is it setting up rewards that might be, you know, might be astray from what we would consider to be appropriate rewards for a successful academic career?
I think that this really introduces the perspectival nature of rewards, because let's say as an academic, you have different trajectories that you could be seeking within the framework of academia. You could be seeking to be someone who has a public voice, who is consulted on current affairs, for example. And it's sort of an and, or you could be someone who is seen as a very respected person within the academy, but without much of a profile outside of it. And I think there's a question as to how much you can do both, which people are grappling with, because the rewards don't necessarily always enable both of those things to happen concurrently.
Yeah, not just the rewards, but also just the time required to do everything.
Yeah, but I almost mean, and I am only hypothesizing or suggesting this, I don't know for sure, but that in some more traditional communities, the act of, for example, doing a TED talk or commenting publicly could be seen as detracting from a credible academic voice. I think that that's in more traditional communities, there is still some tension around that. So they don't necessarily align in that sense either, if you see credibility as a reward, especially if in order to partake in those activities, the incentives or the system, I suppose, requires you to simplify your research and your messages to such an extent that they can no longer be taken seriously within the research community that you are also trying to speak to. So that's where I see the trade-off potentially coming in.
So this is related to this. As an example, at my university, and I think other universities have the same, you have assessments of your teaching and you have assessments of your research. But you don't, in neither of these assessments looks at how does the education support your research? How does it support the research support your education? So how are these connected? And so at every point you are, so to say, rewarded by only thinking about one thing and not thinking about the other thing. Instead of seeing the potential for example, doing meaningful research and combining it with meaningful education and looking for ways of how can I actually combine both. So maybe one example would be that when you're doing a PhD, you are expected to write your articles, so to say, yourself. While actually a lot of academia is, of course, also working with other people, not just your supervisors, but also, for example, colleagues from other universities. So what I was thinking about is, say, if you were to say with your PhD, every PhD is required to publish one paper with a fellow PhDer from, say, the same department or the same faculty. What kind of dynamics you then would get in how people choose the topics and how people start to collaborate with other people, etc. Because then you incentivize the actual collaboration. So that what I'm trying to say is that it seems to me a lot of times that, for example, the silos that we complain about in organizations come partially because the reward systems and the way that responsibilities are divided up make people work in these silos because they're actually being rewarded to stay in these silos.
I want to give an example of that, which I think is, and this comes from my own doctoral program that Ralph and I attended at George Washington. Our comprehensive exams were group exams. They were not individual. And to my knowledge, I don't know of any other university or even program within George Washington that that did this. And it was precisely to try to enforce exactly the point that you raised, Fritjof, if you want the program to encourage greater collaboration among academics, then actually test them on it. You give a group a set of research questions or a set of big questions that they've got to tackle, and they have to come up with a collaborated response, and they have to demonstrate that everybody is an equal participant. Now, I'll tell you that is a hard system to do because you can imagine all of the incentives for not following through at an individual level, of not being a team player, that you can sort of, you know, like you could try to loaf your way through this and come out passing and all that sort of thing. So there are some perverse incentives that you've got to have that you've got to account for. And it's hard. And I think that's perhaps why why that particular approach has not taken off.
It's interesting, though, because I'm now wondering whether what you're describing is that we should improve the system where you can have a reward for, like, that we've gotten the behavior wrong. We actually want collaboration, so therefore we should reward collaboration. So we just had, we were doing what Kerr describes, rewarding the wrong thing, rewarding individual achievement while hoping for group work. So now we should reward group work, as in your example, Tom. And so we've adjusted the reward system. That would be one way of seeing it. But I also was reflecting on maybe Kerr is setting up a bit of a false dichotomy here, you know, A or B, that perhaps there are more complex systems that can reward a greater range of behaviors in a certain dynamic, so in different levels at different times, for example, to make sure we're getting a more balanced system. It seems actually quite binary now when I look at the title.
I agree. I think the question is also, or the title is also maybe a false dichotomy, like you said. And I think it's for universities and for the academic community. It's individual achievement and collaboration, and yet the reward system is very poorly established to reward the collaborative part of academia. So in that way, you might say it needs improvement. Well, I see developments in more connection between, at least in my department, between education and research and valorization as well. So, not only through funding possibilities, but also by awards given to teachers because of their focus in using research to improve education and have an impact as well in society. So I'm positive that this complexity of rewarding several aims or goals within academia is slowly developing.
Yeah, and to your point, Ella, about thinking a little bit too much binary, the Bettger-Greer article actually had an interesting example. When they, by the way, the article is very interesting in the way it sort of recasts a lot of Kerr's examples. And one of them that this phrase kind of caught my eye, and it was how Bettger and Greer recast the medicine case about the type 1 and type 2 errors that doctors ago. And they said instead of on the folly of rewarding A while hoping for B, they said that Kerr's example was more like on the poor fine-tuning of our sanctions against too much A while expecting some A and hoping for mostly B. Not a catchy title. But that's exactly the kind of the things that was going through my mind, both when I read Kerr's example and Bettger and Greer's, is, all right, at one superficial level, we're talking about a reward system of rewarding A but hoping for B, but there's also rewarding A while hoping for the absence of B, or rewarding A hoping for the opposite of B. Or, you know, there's several permutations you can come up with depending on how you cast the example or the situation given and where you stand in it. Because obviously, if you are if you're an opponent of what either A or B stand for, then you're definitely going to cast the story your way, which is to say, you know, A is, you know, we're rewarding A while sanctioning something that is important to me, which defeats the whole purpose of the reward system.
Yeah, and within that, and I'm reminded now of when I was a high school teacher, I was teaching pretty young students. And in that context, we would, as teachers, think a lot about what kind of, there's a sort of framework around it, what kind of level are we encouraging our students to think on? And the idea of sort of following rules, looking for punishments and rewards, the use of those kind of mechanisms was seen as pretty basic and not something to stick with. That the wider idea would actually be, if you try and sort of legislate or give a rule to every single behavior that you want to see or don't want to see, and you have to give a reward for everything that you want, that can get enormously complex once we start recognizing the complexity of these systems, so that people have whole handbooks and, you know, a wall full of instructions for how to be a student in this classroom. It gets pretty complicated, whereas you can synthesize these sort of ideals within something like be kind, you know, be respectful, be decent, and you can actually start to encourage the value that will likely lead to all of this kind of behavior that you want. And that can end up being much more efficient, but also potentially more valuable, because otherwise you have to keep adapting all of these rules and rewards every time the context changes. So from one classroom to another, or from one year to another. And that's very laborious. You spend all your time trying to inform people of what the rules are and what they're going to be rewarded for, when actually what you want is a general principle of behavior to carry across different contexts.
Yeah, and you don't want the whole path to be described and laid out for students, right? So be it in primary or secondary or higher education. So we can write all these instructions and provide all these instruments, but it also takes away the whole idea of learning and finding their way for themselves, personal development and growth through education. So I agree with you that you need the complexity there by not adjusting constantly your educational agendas and trying to highlight the whole path of development. It's wayfinding for students for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so much value in the independence that you gain from figuring it out for yourself and figuring out what is intrinsically valuable to you and how that aligns with society or the organization's wider goals and imperatives, that it actually sets you up much better to deal with complexity when you're faced with it, when there's no rule book. And I think that's also something that was covered to some extent in the Budger and Greer article, which responded to Kerr around it's better to help and teach individuals to handle complexity and to handle inconsistent demands rather than making organizations responsible for eliminating them, they say. So I really appreciated that perspective from this response article.
It reminds me a bit of the thing with education that, say, for example, with math, that for a long time, and still I think in a lot of countries, math problems you get are not math problems that are out there. It's artificial problems. And students don't know how to translate the problems that they actually face in the real world, so to say, into mathematical problems, which means that a lot of the math that they get, they in the end, they don't really know how to use in the day-to-day. Which brings me to another point from Tom before about the group exams. Seeing how a group copes with the problem that goes beyond, so to say, the current reward rules, etc., and then trying to teach them how to, so to say, themselves come out of the situation is something very different from what we see a lot of times, that we just ask the students the questions that they already have the answer to if they just read the book right.
Yes, and that's one of the incentives behind using this other format, is that it also sort of allows the students to be comfortable with feeling vulnerable, because one of the things that is an evaluative aspect of that type of a group exam is the ability of the groups to resolve conflict on the spot. You're essentially encouraged to lay out all perspectives. So if you have four students who have very different views on a particular problem, you're not looking for a group answer. You're looking for a group dialogue. It really, really is kind of countercultural in terms of the way we think of what an exam is supposed to do, of basically you are capable of regurgitating what you've learned, or demonstrating that you've mastered the knowledge given. Perhaps oversimplifying, but in a lot of ways that's what it is.
And I think it makes sense that that has historically been the aim, that we grade the individual student because of one of the mechanisms that Kerr was talking about, this number of objectivity. And if one student has sat one exam under exam conditions and they come up with a grade, then we have this illusion that we have an objective understanding of how well they know the material. That's much more complex in this group situation that you're describing. So even though it seems to have so much merit, perhaps one of the reasons why it doesn't travel more rapidly is because of this mechanism that Kerr has identified around the objectivity of the single number.
Oh, absolutely. And especially like when I think about how, we're preparing our high school students for, the competition of getting into the college of their choice, the standardized test numbers become very prominent, as do the list of extracurricular activities and some of the other things that separate your son or daughter's 4.0 grade point average from those of thousands of others across the country. Those summary descriptive statistics become very powerful, and it's hard to break, because if you're going to introduce subjectivity, how do you as a college administrator, for example, judge fairly between tens of thousands of applicants for only 100 slots? And it is a very, very hard type of a reward system to move away from, because it opens up a lot more ambiguity.
Yeah, and I kind of fear that these very tailored reward systems that can deal with ambiguity and complexity, that they're often in a place of privilege. So I think of, I hear tales of university systems where you don't sit an exam, you have a conversation with the instructor. And that just sounds like some mythical far-off country, although I know that still happens in some places. But one of the reasons why those sort of exam structures are not possible in my own institution, for example, is that they're just not efficient and there are not the resources to support them. So whenever I think of these really tailored and reward structures and systems that are much more tailored towards ambiguity, complexity, creativity, subjectivity, they always tend to be in environments that are quite privileged, whereas in very large organizations with perhaps a lot of low-skilled workers, the burger flipping example comes back to mind. Then we're back to the sort of reward systems that Kerr is talking about.
Yeah, but I also kind of want to go back to the discussion we had a little bit earlier about the purpose of the organization. And there is, to me, and using the education as an example, there is a higher purpose that sometimes gets lost in our discussion about, all of the discussion we've had about reward systems of the universities, et cetera. I mean, what is it that ultimately we should view, I think, as the measure of success of an educational program? And that's performance after graduation. That's after the student has, let's say, at the high school level, after the student has gone through adolescence and has learned the basic tools of being able to demonstrate life skills, to be able to push them out into the world, and they are capable of managing their own lives, doing all of the things that we would want them to be able to do to contribute to society, whatever it is that you want. Obviously that's very aspirational, very, very difficult to measure, and certainly almost impossible to measure from inside the classroom. But we don't – that it just get, and because it is so difficult, it kind of gets lost in all of this conversation about what we're trying to ultimately do. What is our purpose as a educational organization? And I think that same challenge kind of follows the medical profession. What is the ultimate purpose of the medical profession? What is the service that it provides to society, et cetera? And unfortunately, because of the narrow way in which we're looking at reward systems, that whole conversation doesn't, I don't know that that takes place to the extent that we would want it to.
So let's take this podcast as an example. So we could look at performance as the quality of the audio that we're recording, that that there's not too many hiccups there, that we don't have these problems, etc. But it's a lot harder to actually look at, okay, so did we deliver quality in this podcast, in this specific session? What would quality look like discussing CUR, discussing rewards, etc.? It's a lot easier to look at the things that we sort of say can objectively look at than actually having the discussion again, like, hey, what would good look like here in this specific case? Instead of having like a generic answer, but also having a specific answer, okay, what are we striving for in this case?
Yeah, and then but then you also have the perspective or the interpretation of goals. So is quality a goal of or is it an element of performance? How do we as podcasters, but also the listeners, look at, well, performance of a podcast? And in that way I'm happy that Tom stressed that it's about what if we go back to the educational example, that it's not performance in the system, it's after the system, you might say. So I'm very happy that he stressed managing their own lives, right? So not managing organizations or performing well in their profession, or but it's very much on living their own lives. And I think that's a very valuable and aspect of goodness, I think, of looking at reward systems.
I might steal Pedro's line here and say, if I may be devil's advocate, there's also an element here where there can be overreach, I think, in how a system is then trying to manage your behavior within an organization, as an example. Or if we start to try and assess impact, which is a huge imperative around the world at the moment in all sorts of different domains, we can also end up with a very simplistic understanding of that. So, Tom, with the example of what is the purpose of university, it's how people do after university. That now is being conceived of in terms of earning potential. What did this degree get you in terms of salary in the workplace in your first few years out? And now there's even discussions of adapting the fee structure of university to align with that. And so that's very problematic, but has the same issue of Kerr's emphasis on what we can make objective and what we can measure and what is visible becoming a proxy for this wider goal or assessment of impact. So that's a problem. But then in organizations, there's also an increasing initiative to try and manage your behavior outside of the organization. So you now have to be a kind of good person, but in terms that the organization appreciates. So, for example, are you exercising and you will get a gym membership, or are you eating healthily and they'll provide dinner? And it sort of seems to me a bit of overreach from the organization's perspective, but they kind of bring those behaviors back into their own goals, because a healthy employee is a productive employee. So I kind of sometimes like it when these structures like reward systems just stay on their own turf and stick to the context that they're trying to manage and don't try and reach too far. So that's my devil's advocate perspective on this.
Oh, that's definitely a fair point. I mean, there has to be a reason, there has to be a legitimate reason for being outside or for any sort of a reward system to look outside of the organization. And it typically, for me, would have to do with whether or not, the degree to which the demands of the position or the demands of the organization require sort of a 24/7, 365 perspective, such as, you would expect that a medical hospital that has to have doctors on call, that the doctors aren't, that when the doctor is called, that they are responsive and they're not drunk, there's sort of like that organizational, there's that aspect of you've got to be able to reward and sanction behaviors outside if it has a direct link to purpose of the organization. But beyond that, I agree, it does get problematic the further out you go.
Yes, I really this article has really got me thinking again. Also the graduation students that I'm supervising right now and how this might relate to their work. And I'm really interested in this whole thing about trying to design the reward system or keep designing the reward system and see, okay, so we're doing this now, we're rewarding A, but are we actually getting B? And how can we maybe change A to actually get B? Or do we really need to have B? Maybe we should have C. And how these kind of discussions could be kept going in an organization despite or even because of the reward system. So for me, very inspiring reading.
Yeah, thank you all for an interesting discussion. And I think what I would take is I take it also as a warning, our discussion and the article itself, how easily we fall into flawed reward systems and how complex these things are. And maybe one thing that as a final takeaway, which we didn't really explicitly address, but in a way our discussion and also the article stresses also the multi-level aspect of reward system. So it's within the individual, it's internalized, but it's also at team level, it's in organizations, it's in the level of the field level. So the example of the universities, it's at policies, but it's also something for society in general. So aren't we rewarding prestige, status, these kind of individual aspects while hoping for good citizens and more professionals? These are things I would like to take away.
Well, I've been a convert to this article for quite a while, so I feel like it's been framing the way that I've experienced organizations for some time. And it's a bit of a habit almost to go, oh, this is irrational. If only we could work out the reward system, or you feel like you can see why things are not going the way that you think are rational and better. And so actually, to me, something that's been very rewarding and important was to visit this article on the wisdom of rewarding A while hoping for B by Budger and Greer, because here they give the counter voice to Kerr and they say, you know what, organizations by kind of design and through history are not that rational. There's more than one goal. There's long-term goals and short-term goals, and there's a whole history and complicated narrative to the way that things are now, and that actually sometimes these reward systems are complex and apparently competing for a reason. And so it's made me a little more cognizant that I need to perhaps acknowledge that complexity and not rely too much on Kerr, although I still really appreciate this article.
And I'll conclude by agreeing and just kind of adding on the aspect of time, that what we think is a reward today may not be perceived as a reward tomorrow. So it requires that constant vigilance to make sure that what you're trying to get out of your reward system really is what you're getting. And it takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of attention. And that concludes episode 57. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Please join us again as we discuss another classic work from organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations. Thank you.